Welcome to Modern Sign Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at bjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This morning, something a bit different. While VJ Books primarily specializes in action, adventure, mystery, and science fiction, they also support other genres, in this case, a Western. But not just any Western. Our guest today is Max Allen Collins, Seamus Award winner, 2017 Mystery Writers of America Grand Master Edgar Award winner, New York Times bestseller, author of fiction, nonfiction, graphic novels, and musician as well. He's an author of a number of popular mysteries, including Quarry, which is adopted in a Cinemax original crime drama. And though there's that little film thing that he did with a couple of newcomers called Paul Newman and Tom Hanks called Road to Perdition. Lately, he's been doing Westerns in conjunction with the late Mickey Spillane, who left him as his executor of his literary estate. And this is the third in his series, featuring the hard-boiled, hard-bitten, and tougher-than-larger-than-life lawman, Caleb York. And we're very pleased to welcome Max Allen Collins this morning. Good morning, sir.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
What a delight to have you. I have to, before we get into the book itself, I want to go back a little bit. Were you always going to be a writer?
Actually, early on, I mean, when I was a little kid, till I was about 12, I wanted to be a cartoonist, because the comic book interest and the Dick Tracy comic strip interest, that was the first thing. And so I was doing my own little comic books and passing them around to my friends. And then when I was 12 or 13, they started showing Private Eye TV shows. Mm-hmm. On, and it was a big craze that was Peter Gunn and 77 Sunset Strip, but also there were a lot of TV shows based on book series. There was mm-hmm. A Thin Man, there was a Philip Marlowe, and significantly a Mike Hammer.
Yes.
That led me into reading what they now call noir, but what we then called hard-boiled.
Yeah.
And I got just swept up in that kind of character and that kind of prose that Chandler, that Spillane, that sort of noir poetry really caught me as a kid. And the drawing kind of dropped by the wayside, and I started sending books out when I was a young teenager. I sent my first novel out when I was 14 or 15.
Wow.
Thank God it didn't get published. but through high school, I wrote four novels and tried to market them. So by the time I got into college, while I hadn't sold anything, I was a bit of a pro in terms of knowing how things worked, and mm-hmm. I'd done a lot of writing, which is important. So I kind of went into college on a pretty high level of craft, and sold my first two books while I was in graduate school.
Nice.
And I've never looked back. Well, I look back all the time, to tell you the truth, but that's just what you're supposed to say.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And again, you understand the tropes. And one of the things about the tropes is if you understand them, you can play with them. And we'll get to that after a bit. But I also want to find out a little bit about your musical background. I understand that you were in bands called Daybreakers and Cruisin'. Is that right?
That's right. The Daybreakers was the band I started my senior year in high school, and that lasted all through college. And we did have one national record out, which became somewhat notorious, called Psychedelic Siren. That was on a subsidiary of Atlantic called Dial.
Okay.
And that, if you were to be foolish enough to put the words Psychedelic Siren into YouTube, you'll find that song has been covered by four or five bands worldwide. And it's pretty amazing, something I wrote as a kid in 1967, for that to take off in that even minor way. But that our recording of it is on quite a few those Nuggets kind of mm-hmm. CDs where they do garage bands of the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're on three or four of those where they take our one little claim to fame. And then we got in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. and that was about 10 years ago that we got in, and then Cruisin', which is my classic rock oldies band that's been around since 1974. We are being inducted into the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, and there has been a lot of recording. We've done not a wealth of it, but there have been four or five CDs over the years, and mm-hmm. I'm very proud that we're getting into the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The thing about Cruisin' is I got together with one of my friends from the previous band, and like I say, it was around 73, 74, mm-hmm. and we did not like the music that was out at the time. Had we waited a little bit and New Wave would have come along, that would have sounded very familiar to us, but we did not particularly like the disco era and so on.
I said,
why don't we take the old list out and call it Nostalgia? And so, the American Graffiti film had just hit and was bringing all that 50s music back, and Sha-na-na was happening.
Yeah.
And so we said, let's be a 60s band. Never mind that the 60s were only 5 years ago.
You must have been one of the first.
Maybe the first 60s band in the country.
Wow.
I know we were the first in the Midwest.
Well,
there was a little period where we were professional. There were about 2 or 3 years where that was my job, and then when I got the Dick Tracy comic strip, I dropped out of the band for a little while, and they went on. So, and then we became Weekend Warriors over the years, and we still play about, I would say, half a dozen times a year.
Sweet, that's wonderful.
In the good weather, not when it's snowing here in Iowa. We do it in. When the weather gets good, we do about once a month.
You hit a little county fair here, a little veterans hall there, and have some fun.
That's right. We don't do bars anymore. We mostly do events like class reunions or where the city has a fun, as you say, a fun fair or something. But the bars we very seldom do.
Ah, well, there you go. Well, it's good to know that you are a multi-talented person of all sorts of things. And I understand, well, there's another thing I want to mention to you. There's this thread of humor that runs through your work. And it gets kind of dark in some of the noir stuff. But were you from a humorous family? A lot of funny folks in the family?
Well, I don't know. I've always been, my father frequently told me I was a smart ass, and this was back when this is back when that was pretty salty language.
Yes.
I was also called a wiseacre, and you can think of all of those terms. I was a spoiled only child, and I had a lot of back talk.
Ah.
And the occasional backhand, as it was in those days. But I there's always been a good thread of humor in the work. I probably should point to novels more, but the truth is a lot of how I developed really did come out of television because of those private eye TV shows. And my favorite show as a kid was Maverick.
Ah.
So Maverick was a show that in some respects was a very traditional Western, but had that bit of parody and that mm-hmm. bit of satire and humor through most of it. And you think of James Garner, and he was very typically the kind of hero that I would picture.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the Mike Hammer show with Darren McGavin, McGavin brought a lot of humor to Mike Hammer, which is, I think, in the books to a degree, but isn't usually associated with Mike Hammer and Mickey Splaine as a major part of what he did. But there's a lot of black humor in Mickey Splaine, and I... Mm-hmm. I definitely play that. Probably, it's probably the one thing that I emphasize more than Mickey did.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I interview a lot of authors, and I was talking to one famous lady mystery writer who said, I like Spillane because he said, I shot her in one eye to see what she looked like in the other. And she says, I could never write that, but I admire that. So there you go.
Well, you know who was a big Spillane fan? Sue Grafton.
Ah. Uh-huh.
She said that... Reading Spillane was, and her father was a really good mystery writer, but she said that reading Spillane was what really got her excited about doing Private Eye.
Yeah.
That is seldom mentioned, although she frequently mentioned it herself in interviews.
Mary Higgins Clark I was talking to, I did the quote from just then. So, but, you know, obviously the influence has been huge. How did you and Spillane come to meet?
Well, again, I everything kind of flows out of that late 50s, early 60s enthusiasm that I got from the TV shows, because they sent me out. I always have been somebody that if there was a movie that I liked or a TV show that I liked that had a novel as the source, I would go read the novel. Or if it was just an historical film or TV show, I would go read about it, mm-hmm. find nonfiction works. And so I started reading Hammett, Chandler, and Spillane, basically in that order when I was about 13. And being kind of obsessive, as you may have already guessed, I would go to the library and go to what was called the National Periodical Guide, where you could look up and see what had been written about people you're interested in. And then, of course, the libraries then had stacks of magazines and newspaper files they could go to. So I'd read about what was said about Hammett, I'd read about what was said about Chandler, and in those two were pretty much revered out of the gate. Mm-hmm. They got fantastic reviews. I came to Spillane, who I liked just as much, and he was attacked. He was, the literary critics said he was terrible, and the social commentators said he had ruined mystery fiction and was fomenting juvenile delinquency. So that was a shock to me, because I thought he was terrific. And so I early on became a kind of defender of his. And as I got into what you would call fandom, I would write for Armchair Detective and other magazines, other fanzines, articles about Mickey and his work, basically defending him, being a voice in the wilderness, defending the most popular writer in America at the time, but somebody had to defend him. And I became somewhat known as a guy that, I was the Spillane go-to guy. Mm. So there was a convention, a mystery convention in 1981. That convention is called BoucherCon. You probably are familiar with
it.
And it's named after Anthony Boucher, the famous critic. And in 1981, it was in Milwaukee, Beer City, and they decided to have Mickey be one of the guests of honor because at that time, Mickey was doing the Miller Lite beer commercials. Very successfully. Successfully. Those commercials ran 18 years.
Wow.
So they came to me and said, we'd like you to be the liaison between the convention and Mickey Spillane. And so...
Yes, wait a minute.
And that's how Mickey and I met. And he was aware that I'd been a champion of his. And very soon I was invited down to South Carolina where I lived. And we began doing some projects together and became personally close. He was my son's godfather, for example. And it was kind of a dream come true. I mean, I've had a very odd career in that sense. I had two idols as a kid. One was Chester Gould, who was the creator of Dick Tracy. And the other was Mickey Spillane. And I ended up being the person who continued the Dick Tracy strip for 15 years as a writer. And when I was a kid, I wanted to be Chester Gould when I grew up. So for a while I was. And then the other thing I wanted to be was my generation's Mickey Spillane. And that has kind of happened in a way. But I'll tell you something funny that Mickey said to me once. We were actually down in South Carolina, and he was driving me around in his pickup truck. We're sitting outside of Hardee's because he liked the biscuits at Hardee's. And he looked at me and he said, "What's this about you wanting to be your generation's Mickey Spillane?" He said, "I'm your generation's Mickey Spillane." He had a good point.
Yeah, there you go. It's not like he gave up or anything along the line.
No, I'm still here. I'm still writing.
Yeah.
But we got very close, and part of why was that Mickey had a lot of friends. He was a very affable, warm guy, and he had tons of friends that he hung out with, and this one would be a lawyer, and this would be a car mechanic, and I mean just all over the spectrum of social classes, shall we say. But he had one friend who was a writer, a guy named Dave Garrity, who lived nearby, that he would talk writing with. And then when Dave passed away, and I knew Dave a little bit, I became the only person he really could talk to about writing.
Mm.
He has had this public persona that pretended that he did not have any real interest in writing. Writing is just a business, and I just give them what they want, and I'm the chewing gum of literature and all this kind of stuff. But he really cared about writing. We would talk into the night about books, about his books, about other authors that we like, about the writing life, the things that are hard, the things that are easy. Mm-hmm. And I became his, his wife says I was his literary son. And he was certainly my literary father.
That's perfect. What a delight. What a culmination of a lot of work. And things, dreams do really come true in this country from time to time.
They can. I think the biggest problem I've had to surmount, and I at least have personally surmounted this, I don't know, I can't know how people perceive me, but I could have been wholly overshadowed by two men like Chester Gould and Mickey Spillane.
Right.
And not been anything but their acolytes. And Gould himself, and we were friends, I was visiting him, and shortly after I'd taken over the writing of the strip, and he told me, you be careful. You need to do your own work, because you can never, if what your primary thing is Dick Tracy, he said, you will never be more famous than me.
Mm-hmm.
You will never, as the Dick Tracy guy, you will always be, no matter how much you accomplish, you will be a footnote. So you need to go out there and establish yourself. It was
great.
Really good advice.
Yeah.
I don't know if I wouldn't have done it anyway, but, and Mickey was somewhat the same way. He wanted me to stand on my own two feet. And I think I've succeeded in that. I think I have accomplished some things that are not just continuations of Dick Tracy and Mike Hammer.
Mm-hmm. This particular book, which, by the way, The Bloody Spur is one of those perfect names because, without giving anything away, I will say it isn't about what's on the end of your boot. It's about a railroad spur.
It has a couple of meanings.
It does. And I just giggled, I have to say, when I figured out that's what it was about. I thought, okay, here's a pro. We're in good hands here.
And it also was someone who was stubborn about selling his land, and, mm-hmm. and his refusal to sell it spurred the mystery.
Correct? Oh, yes. Yeah. So that's the key around which it revolves. I also want to comment, because I want to bounce all over the place, because I took probably four pages of notes in reading the book, because I loved it.
Thank you.
There's an excellent piece at the beginning. We talk about the friendship between Spillane and John Wayne, who apparently commissioned a script for this York character.
Yeah, I am a mystery writer. I'm a suspense writer. But on the other hand, as you may know, for about 10 years as a side job, I did a lot of movie tie-ins,
mm-hmm.
and TV tie-ins. And when I did those TV and movie tie-ins, that was gave me the opportunity to work in a lot of genres and areas that my agent, let's say, would discourage me from doing in real life. So I was able to do sword and sorcery. I was able to do science fiction. I did quite a few war novels, including Saving Private Ryan. And I also did a Western, and that Western was Maverick, which was based on my favorite TV show. So that Western thing was something I had at least written one book, mm-hmm. book in that form. I had also done a book called Black Hats, which is it's going to be coming out again soon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a novel set in 1920 in which old Wyatt Earp meets young Al Capone.
Oh, boy, that sounds like fun. I love the
game. There's a long flashback to the OK Corral, and there's a lot of Western stuff.
Wow.
In that book. And so I already had a little bit of a toe in the water, where the Western was. But what happened was, I was again at a BoucherCon. I was having breakfast. My wife and I, Barb, and I were having breakfast with an editor named Michael Hamilton at Kensington Books. She's great, great person. We're very friendly with her. And Barb and I do a series called it's the Antiques series. They call it the Trash and Treasures Mystery.
Yeah.
But you mentioned humor. These are very funny. I'm going to be immodest about this. They're really funny books that my wife and I write together that are outside of the area of the tough stuff I do. These are cozy mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done quite well. The very first one, which indicates the humor, was called Antiques Roadkill. So that will give you a hint. Mm-hmm. And they're very funny, and my wife has got a great sense of humor, and between the two of us that we make the books extremely funny. So we're sitting there talking to our editor who does cozy mysteries with us. And we're talking about this and that, and I knew she was a Spillane fan. And I also knew that Kensington, one of the things they specialized in was Westerns. They're one of the few publishers that get their books, their Westerns, into Walmart, for example, which
nice.
Is important.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know what? One of the things I have in my files, because I have all the unpublished Spillane material that Mickey asked me to look after, I said, you know, one of the things I have in my files is a screenplay that Mickey did for John Wayne that was never produced, a Western screenplay. And I said, isn't that interesting? And she said, can you give me three?
And you said,
give me three what? And she said, well, novelize the screenplay and give me two sequels. I said, well, I'm kind of uncomfortable with that. I want a novel. I want to do a novel based on this screenplay. But that's really all there is except for some notes and some, you know, there is some other material here, but... She interrupted me and said, well, we give three book contracts in a situation like this, and you have to commit to three.
Oh, dear. What will I do?
Oh, yeah. Dear. But that did have me cross a line because it meant I was, everything else I had done, I had rough drafts or something like this where I had a full screenplay.
Yeah.
So the first book, which is called The Legend of Caleb York, is that's very heavily Spillane because he had written 110-page screenplay.
Wow.
But then I had to go somewhere else with him. I had material Mickey had written about backstory and several drafts of the script, which gave me some material. But I never really thought about being a writer of Westerns. Now, I have loved Western movies over the years and TV shows. And... big fan of John Ford, The Searchers, and Howard Hawks, Rio Bravo, which are both John Wayne pictures, of course. I love the Randolph Scott Westerns that he did with Bud Boddicker, which are these little sort of chamber piece Westerns that he did. They're among my favorite films. I think Comanche Station and I can't remember some of the names of the others, but they're fantastic movies. They really foreshadow Italian Westerns. So, I don't read, this is a terrible thing to admit, but I don't really read Westerns. I have never read many Westerns, so I was pretty intimidated, but I apparently had watched enough movies, and I'm enough of a history buff to know how to do the research. Because what I want to do on Caleb York, and you can tell me whether I'm succeeding, is I want to have one foot in the mythic West, and I want to have one foot in the real West, because the myth, the gunfighter myth, all of that stuff, the John Wayne persona, the Randolph Scott, Audie Murphy, Joel McRae, that stuff, I want to do that. But if you walk into a hardware store, I want you to know what a hardware store in 1885 would have been like. If you eat a meal in the restaurant at the hotel, I want to serve the reader the oyster omelet that they would have gotten when they went into a hotel in 1880 in the West, that kind of stuff. So that you have, which is a typical thing I like to do. I like to do a grounding in reality so that you then you then I kind of make you look the other way where all the melodrama is concerned.
Uh-huh.
Nobody says this, but what we do, most of us, is melodrama. We're not really doing drama. You know, we are doing larger than life. The Sopranos was not realistic.
No.
It was melodrama.
Shocked to hear that somehow. Yes.
Breaking Bad is not realistic. It's melodrama. And you don't have to be ashamed of that. But when did you last hear a writer use that word?
Never. Never.
Yeah.
You're it so far. And you're my interview number 574 of writers. So seriously, that is so. I want to touch back on something you mentioned. You mentioned
sure.
Hardware Store. And one of the notes I took was your description of Clarence Mather and Sons Hardware. And I love this. The scent of the place made York smile. Oiled metal, tobacco, mineral spirits, and wood. It smelled like men getting things done. I love that line.
Thank you.
That was great. And I love the fact you made me look a few things up. I had to look up what the boss of the Planes hat was and realize that's the classic Stetson look.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I always learned something there. I learned what a Missouri Fox
star
was.
Well, you know, I figure I've got two kinds of readers.
Yeah.
I've got readers that read more Westerns than I've ever read. I mean, I read Shane, okay?
Yeah. All right. Good boy. Yeah.
Okay. And I read... I told my wife the other day, I think the last Western I had read was the novelization of Brio Bravo, you know, and the Maverick, the Whitman, young adult juvenile book based on Maverick.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's my background in Western. That's actually not true because I've read some Louis L'Amour I probably read 50 Westerns in my life, so I'm being a little bit
but not to the extent
melodramatic.
Yeah,
I'm being a little bit melodramatic, but I'm not somebody that would read a Western unless it was the book that The Searchers was based on, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel a little bit like a pretender, so I make sure that I'm using details that somebody that knows the West and reads a lot of Westerns will resonate well, that I try to get the guns right, that
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff.
Oh, yes, that's important.
But I also know that there's going to be mystery readers who come because of my name and in particular because of Spillane's name.
Right.
So for that reason, I don't explain this stuff so that maybe they will go to Google and they will go look and see that the word bug is an insult in those days.
Yeah.
That guy's a big bug, you know, that's a bad guy. And that's what I hope, that's how I hope it will be embraced by these two similar but different audiences.
Well, if there's a Venn diagram that shows some overlap between, because this is a mystery as well as a Western.
Yeah, how could I figure if I'm going to do Westerns with Spillane's name on them.
Yeah.
They've got to either have a mystery element or a strong crime element.
Yeah.
I would say Caleb York, the first book, The Legend of Caleb York, there is kind of a mystery, which is the stranger who rode into town, is that Caleb York or is it not Caleb York? Because Caleb York is supposed to be dead
mm-hmm.
in the first book. And I never reveal who he is till the last two or three chapters. He's just the stranger who rode into town. How classic a Western concept.
Yeah,
can you do than that? So you have that element, but the rest of that book is crime. There's an evil sheriff or a gangster sheriff who basically has a gangster. I mean, it's up against the mob. He's up against the gang.
Mm-hmm.
The hero. The next two books, I put a literal murder mystery in.
Yep.
Both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one I'm going to do next is going to be crime again.
Ah,
so
okay.
There's going to be a strong crime or mystery element in any Caleb York novel. And there will be at least five because I got a contract to do two more.
Gee, what a shame, yeah. But
yeah,
I
I'm a freelance writer. It's fine to hear this stuff about Road to Perdition and Grandmaster and all that stuff, but I still have to have jobs. I have to have gigs, and I have to go out. And it's just like being in the band. You have to. Your next job is something that you have to go after.
Okay.
I've one of the reasons why I've done so much is that if they call me up and say, "Do you think you could write you think you can write trading cards about gangsters? Sure, no problem. Can you write a screenplay? Absolutely. And you always say yes, like an actor.
Oh, yeah.
Ask an actor if he can roller skate. He says, I've been doing it since I was a kid. And then he hangs the phone up and says, geez, I got to go buy some roller skates.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it works.
Yeah.
Well, at least it has for me, and that's kept me. I think the fact that I can do comics and I've done some films and that I do nonfiction. Big thing coming up, I'd like to mention a big deal this year is going to be a book called Scarface and the Untouchable, Al Capone and Elliot Ness and the Battle for Chicago. This is a gigantic, like 150,000 word nonfiction book that will tell for the first time the real story of Elliot Ness and the Untouchables, and a lot about Capone that's never been known.
Cool. Can we pre-order that already? Is it set up?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you
okay.
can. You can. I would be glad to sign it.
Right.
I have a co-author named A. Brad. Well, his name is Brad Schwartz, but he puts an A period in front of it.
That's more Arthurian.
So I would have made myself the Brad Schwartz, but his choice to be A. Brad Schwartz, okay? And he's a brilliant young writer who is right now studying a PhD in history at Princeton. He couldn't get into Muscatine Community College like I did, but he got into Princeton. And he had a op-ed piece in the New York Times just within a few days ago in which he talked about how, in the wake of the recent St. Valentine's Day massacre, the original St. Valentine's Day massacre led to the banning of Tommy guns.
That's right. I'd forgotten.
So that's a very interesting parallel that he made. And he wrote a brilliant piece about that. You can find that online.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I have a whole bunch more questions, but you've been already very generous with your time. I'm going to ask one more just because it's an oddball.
Sure.
It's more of a comment a bit. And if you have the skill to know the tropes inside out, you can play with them. And there's one place in this book, The Bloody Spur, where you play with the trope of the young kid gunfighter out to make his name by challenging the old pro.
Right.
And what you do is resolve
this credit sequence.
Gunsmoke opening credit. You resolve this off camera, off stage, and it just with a little line later that somebody says, this is a spoiler, and I apologize for this, but it's a minor one. He ends up breaking his hand instead of killing the guy.
Yeah.
Everybody wins. And I love that twist on it.
Well, you know, I actually don't think of them as tropes. I think of them as conventions.
Okay.
And the conventions are there for a reason. And that is, it's just like a cliche all cliches come out of truth.
Mm-hmm.
All cliches were once good observations that we just made too many times.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you don't avoid the conventions. You just try to use them in a, shall we say, more creative or imaginative way.
Mm-hmm.
Think about I, the Jury, and we'll do a spoiler alert here. So, if you've never read the end of I, the Jury by Mickey Spillane, put your fingers in your ears, and not all day, just for the next 30 seconds. The end of I, the Jury is really the end of the Maltese Falcon. It is the girl that the detective has fallen in love with, the woman the detective has fallen in love with, turns out to be the killer. And in the one book, Sam Spade turns her in. Okay, that immediately becomes a trope or a convention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spillane does it, but Spillane sets it up that the killer is someone who killed his best friend, a guy who lost his arm in the Pacific, saving Mike Hammer's life. And he has sworn vengeance over the corpse of his friend. He doesn't care who did it. He's going to kill that person. And at the end of I, the Jury, he kills the woman he loves, which is something that, because she's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that follows him, haunts him throughout the books. Mm-hmm. I mean, they say he's a misogynist, which is baloney. The other PI in the office is a woman, the beautiful Velda.
Yeah.
And she's as strong a character as Mike Hammer. So that misogyny thing is a false. That's a trope.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cliche that doesn't have truth at the heart of it. It's people that don't really read the books and don't really know how to interpret and just take the surface. But that's how Spillane took something that was already being overused. The detective sending his lover over to a different place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you have to try to do.
Yeah. I would argue that actually demonstrates he's anything but a misanthrope if he's willing to use women in any position.
Well, the women are very strong in my camera books.
Yeah.
They're extremely strong. And what's hilarious is that when Mickey would be asked this, they'd say, why are there so many women who are the bad guys, the evil ones in the novel? The truth is, if you go and chart them, there are probably a few less women than men in that case. But there have been a number of women who are bad guys in those books. And Mickey would say, well, you got two choices. And he didn't want to talk about it any further than that.
Yeah.
And, of course, he knew that he had not been killing women in every book.
Right.
There's something about him that in that era that just drove critics crazy, and a lot of them weren't really reading him.
Mm-hmm.
When I was researching him back when I was 13 and looking this stuff up in the library, I noticed that there was a specific passage from The Big Kill, very violent, but typical. I could give you 30 other paragraphs just as violent. But somebody had used that paragraph, and then after that, everybody used that paragraph. And I said, they're not reading him. They're reading each other.
This is not unusual in the world of criticism.
No.
Yeah, it's a mob mentality out there sometimes.
Well, I'm so grateful to you for the conversation and for the bookstore's support. It's an incredible service to authors and to readers.
Well, thank you so much. And VJ has been wonderful to work with. And if you're listening to this and you have not got a Max Allen Collins signed book, you better check with VJ because they'll probably have some for you.
And I should tell you that because of the centenary of Mickey's birth, this is his 100th.
That's right, yes.
His 100th birthday. The Buddy Spur is the first that's coming out, but we also have coming two very interesting things. The Last Stand, which is the last book that Mickey wrote that I did not collaborate with him on posthumously. I mean, I'm alive, but he isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I would say it's a posthumous collaboration. It makes it sound like a ghost wrote it, but
yes.
And that could be interpreted a couple of ways.
Yeah.
But that was the last thing, and all I did was edit it, and I did things that he had suggested he wanted done.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming out this month, and in April we have a book called Killing Town, which is the first of my camera story, a manuscript he began before Eye of the Jury in 1945. So we now will have the first of my camera story and the final Mickey Spillane novel published in a 2-month period. His birthday was in March, 1918. So we're celebrating. But you get the gifts.
All right. Well, we love that. And we also love the fact that you've spent an enormous amount of time with us. You've been very generous today.
That's all right.
I appreciate that. Our guest today, Max Allen Collins, the latest is The Bloody Spur. Highly recommended. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up signed copies of all of your favorite books.